Coming up on Tech News Today, we go into the congressional hearing with Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook, sort of. Also, driverless car regulations, or lack thereof. And what's virtual reality doing to our kids? All that and more coming up next on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Tech News Weekly is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 27, recorded Thursday, April 12th, 2018.
This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by LinkedIn Marketing Solutions. Drive brand awareness, generate leads, and build long-term purposeful relationships with LinkedIn Marketing Solutions. To redeem a free $100 LinkedIn ad credit, visit linkedin.com/TNW.
Hello, welcome to Tech News Weekly. This is the show where each week we talk to people who are making and breaking the tech news. I'm Jason Howell. Megan Maroney is out this week. She's enjoying herself on a little bit of a vacation. It's kind of payback because I was out a couple of weeks ago. But joining me, once again, returning to the show, Father Robert Ballester. How's it going, Father Robert?
Wait, I'm not Megan Maroney?
Oh, I don't. Well, actually, that's a question I have for you. Are you?
You know, I don't know. I travel so much these days. I really could be anybody. So,
yeah. Thanks for hopping on, man.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Always my pleasure to be on the show.
We've got some really great things to talk about, stories to talk about. Of course, top of the news, you couldn't avoid it this week. This has been the week that Zuckerberg built. And by built, I mean he went to Washington, sat in front of the highest public scrutiny and walked away from it relatively unscathed. On Tuesday, Mark Zuckerberg sat in front of the House, and on Wednesday in front of the Senate. I may have got that backwards, but anyways, to defend Facebook's business practices on the record. David McCabe was at the two-day hearing, covering the hearing for the full event for Axios. And David's actually here to talk to us all about it. Welcome, David.
It's a pleasure to be back.
Yeah, we're really excited to get you on here, and a little bit jealous that you got to be under all of those, you know, those bright lights in the throngs of press. That I always see these pictures when someone's, you know, in front of the whole hearing, and you see just that wall of press that has the cameras pointed at them. That's a lot of pressure.
It was a lot. Well, the cameras were quite something. The number of photojournalists there who all did excellent work coming out of it was. Immense, but yeah, it's a ton of press attention for Mark Zuckerberg, as well as, I mean, just tons of members of the public who wanted to see him testify. So I think if he didn't know before that there was going to be a lot of interest in it, the minute he walked into the room and saw walls on walls of reporters, you can see it in that photo there a little bit, saw all the photographers, heard all the clicks, it was obvious that this was going to be very, very closely watched.
I'm sure he had a little bit of an inkling that it was going to be that crazy. But I mean, he sat through a lot throughout. You were in the room to watch it all. So from your in-person perspective, like how did it seem like he was handling all that pressure? You know, a lot of us were able to follow on TV, but it's another thing to actually be there. What did you think from that perspective?
You know, he, of course, has this reputation for being a little robotic at times, sometimes a little uncomfortable with the sort of interview type setting. Obviously, everyone has seen The Social Network, which sort of put this in the pop culture narrative. But he actually came across most of the time as pretty calm and collected, especially in the Senate hearing, as he was sort of faced with these pretty basic questions. You could sort of tell that he was on very, very comfortable ground. For him in the House, he was a little more noticeably rattled when he was interrupted a couple times, or that a lot of lawmakers like to do this thing where they say, I have a question you can only answer with yes or no.
Right.
So, you know, will you change your business model? Yes or no, sir. And he responds, well, that's complex. And they say yes or no, right? So he was a little rattled by those exchanges, but generally speaking, pretty calm and collected, and I think more so than at least some people expected going in, given his public reputation.
You know, David, I was at NAB when this was all happening, and it was interesting because the number of booths that had at least one monitor that was tuned to the hearing in some way, shape, or form, they were streaming something. So there was definitely a lot of interest in the broadcast world about how he was handling this. And the comment that I heard echoed through the halls was, he knows who his audience is. And his audience, actually, it's not the Senate and it's not the House. He's actually speaking to a different demographic. He's speaking to the American people. Did you get that sense that this is just more of the Mark Zuckerberg apology tour?
Well, I think you got the sense he was playing to both a little bit in the room. Certainly, he was very aware of kind of the way you respond to a lawmaker, right? Traditionally, CEOs before Congress try not to be defiant. They try not to be condescending. You could tell he was really aware of that, but he was absolutely also aware that anything he said could was on TV and also could end up being replayed over and over on YouTube, on television, and that his users, that the American people would see that. So I think that's absolutely right.
Yeah, there weren't, you know, we've seen this written about, there weren't any, air quotes, viral moments, which is really something that's kind of impressive to say, considering he was under so much scrutiny and there was so much, like, it was so heavily weighted, just the amount of pressure of people watching, looking for any of those moments to be able to point to and say, aha, we finally caught Zuckerberg or Facebook admitting to something or whatever. You really didn't get that. What we did hear from Zuckerberg, it seemed like, and he repeated this throughout both days, is that there was that Facebook as a whole is open to or has some sort of expectation that there will at some point be regulation. Do we have any sense of what kind of regulation Facebook might be okay with? If they're saying that they assume that it's going to happen, then they're opening that door. Are they going to be, you know, is Facebook going to be, I don't know, sad that they opened that door at some point? Like, are they opening the door to something that could be just much larger than they're ready for?
Well, you know, I think that his testimony is pretty careful not to say I'm open to any and all regulation, but that he kept saying, well, you know, I'm not the kind of person who thinks that all regulation is bad regulation. He particularly pointed to the idea that you could codify into law sort of making the terms of service for these sites easier to read and understand, and some other kind of vague suggestions. But he pushed back significantly and avoided significantly committing to any sort of like opt-in requirement, saying that, you know, you have to get a user's affirmative permission to use their data. That was something that made him kind of seemingly uncomfortable. So I think we saw both that there are types of regulation they may be open to, but there are things that they absolutely did not want to open the door to formally.
Yeah.
David, yeah, I want to talk a little bit about competition, because it is striking that he really couldn't name a competitor in the same space as Facebook. But I found even more interesting the fact that he was able to keep Instagram out of the conversation. As much as possible, he took pains to make sure that they weren't equating Instagram with Facebook. They weren't going to look at Instagram the same way they were looking at Facebook. Is that part of his strategy? He understands that there's regulation coming. He knows that Facebook membership is declining a little bit in that very important 25 or so demographic. Is Instagram sort of the parachute for him in case this goes the wrong way?
Well, you know, I think we've certainly seen Facebook invest in Instagram and WhatsApp as a way to make sure that they're sort of on the bleeding edge of how people communicate. You know, as for the fact that it didn't come up much, I think it's very telling that he kept citing this study that says, well, people use 8 apps to communicate on average. When asked about the competition concerns and competition questions around Facebook, and I saw some reporting from someone at the Washington Post that said that actually 4 of those apps, or 3 or 4 of those apps, are apps that are owned by Facebook. Now, they're different services. People use them differently. But certainly, you know, he didn't get into, or lawmakers didn't bring him into really conversations about how Facebook's market share is not just Facebook, the Facebook platform. It's Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp, and Messenger.
Do you think that's just because they didn't understand? They didn't know that? Their interns didn't prepare them for that? Or were they just so focused on Facebook and getting their points in front of the press?
You know, I think that there weren't that many exchanges about competition, and they were fairly high level. You know, one was one between Lindsey Graham and Zuckerberg, where Lindsey Graham said, "Do you think you're monopoly?" And he said, "Well, it certainly doesn't feel that way," to some laughter. But you know, I think they just didn't go that far into depth. In depth, you know, they did talk a bit about Messenger data collection and WhatsApp data collection. So the services did come up, but in terms of what they mean for the market question, they just never really got there. And I think part of that was that so much of the hearings were focused on privacy, the competition and antitrust was sort of a sideline.
Yeah, and I mean, if you watch both days, like, there was a high focus, you know, big focus on what you're talking about there. It also touched on some of the other scandals is the wrong word, but some of the other kind of points of focus that we've heard over the years, one of those being this concern that Facebook and probably the larger Silicon Valley tech community at large is in some ways operating their business with some sort of political motivation behind it. Possibly, you know, they mentioned censorship of conservative views. Zuckerberg talked a little bit about that. Were you convinced with what you heard? Like, I know that there were some people who were questioning Zuckerberg that felt pretty confident that there was some sort of, you know, political motivation behind some decisions behind the scenes. Do you think he did a fair job answering that?
You know, I think that's something that came up many, many times. Clearly, a lot of Republicans concerned about that or more concerned about that than they were about Cambridge Analytica, which obviously taps into some Republican politics.
Right.
You know, I think his answer was essentially the same every time. It was, I care a lot about this and we don't do it. We don't, you know, engage in bias distribution based on bias. Whether lawmakers came away from that totally convinced, I think, remains to be seen. My guess is, you know, I've been covering Facebook in Washington now for several years, and like these controversies around the suppression of political views, particularly conservative views, tend to pop up with some regularity. So I'm not sure that anything he said will stave that off, given that it's just essentially what the company's been saying for years and more. More scandals have always come up. This time it was the limiting reach of a video duo called Diamond and Silk, who support the president. We heard about Diamond and Silk a lot in the hearing rooms. And so I think it remains to be seen. But if history is any guide, him just saying we don't do it probably won't stop the next controversy from coming apart.
Speaking of that controversy, the next controversy, there's actually going to be most likely a separate hearing for the Cambridge Analytica issue. This seemed more like a tongue lashing. This was Mark Zuckerberg getting pulled in front of the refs and essentially being said, told bad, don't do this again. Do you expect a different tenor for the Cambridge Analytica hearing? Because that sounds like something that they can actually really drag people to the carpet on and perhaps come up with some regulations, some sort of plan of action versus this, which was just, okay, we've shown you that we were hard on Facebook.
Yeah, I mean, the Cambridge Analytica hearing will be pretty heated, my guess would be. You know, it remains to be seen exactly what that will look like. But obviously, Democrats are very interested in the Trump angle on Cambridge Analytica, the relationship with Bannon, with the Mercers. And I don't think they will hold back on that. That obviously complicates Republicans' concerns. But also, Republicans share a lot of the data privacy concerns. So I would imagine, given that Cambridge is sort of the source of all of this angst, that they are at the center of this privacy scandal, that it will be a significantly heated hearing. Whether or not that spurs regulation, I think, is a question it's hard to answer until lawmakers hear what they hear and then come out and say, this is how it influenced me.
Yeah, not just Cambridge Analytica, you know, in a separate hearing. I would imagine we're probably going to, at some point, see more of this with other tech CEOs facing similar scrutiny. It seems like the lights are on, you know, as far as this issue is concerned, and there's a lot of attention to it. In the end, you know, at the end of the day, or the 2 days, rather, what would you say were the most pressing unanswered questions? What are the things that we hoped to hear that we didn't get any indication of?
I think we did not hear a great explanation of how they came to the decision not to notify users about this Cambridge Analytica data leak. We heard again and again sort of what they decided and the why they decided, but we didn't really hear a lot about the how, who was in the room. You know, he was asked, were you in a conversation about the decision not to tell users? And he said, I don't remember that conversation. He actually corrected himself. He said, well, we couldn't ban Cambridge Analytica because they weren't on our platform. And then he said, well, actually they were, I didn't give you the right answer. And sort of stunningly, no lawmaker asked the question again, you know, why didn't you ban them? So I think we didn't get a great answer of how at the highest levels of Facebook or the highest levels that the scandal reached, this played out. And I'll be curious to see if that is a question that we get answers to in the future.
Sure.
David, I'm just interested in some last thoughts here. What kind of grade would you give Facebook in general and specifically Zuckerberg? Looking at his performance in front of the Senate, in front of the House, how does this play out?
Well, I think we did not see the needle move much on regulation, as we wrote on Axios this morning. And that is because, you know, there wasn't one major gaffe or one mistake that really pushed particularly Republican lawmakers to say, well, we have to overcome our traditional aversion to regulation. We have to speed ahead of the process. So essentially, they're where they were before, which is to say, we're concerned regulation may be necessary, but not to outright say, here's what we're doing and here's when we're doing it. And that was also aided by the fact that there was no real idea that they coalesced around in terms of, well, if we're going to regulate Facebook, this is what it looks like. We may see that happen in the coming days. I'm sure that staff members are vetting the proposals that are out there, writing their own, but they're not at that place yet.
Awesome stuff. David McCabe with Axios, axios.com. David, where can people follow you online if they want to find your work?
They can follow me at dmccabe on Twitter.
Right on. David, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us about this today. And I'm sure we'll see you in the background during the Cambridge Analytica hearing as well.
I might not get as good a seat again. You know, they assign those out. And so we'll see. But it's always great to join you. And thank you for having me.
Thank you. We'll have you again back soon. Thank you again.
It could be the newest game. It'll be, yes. Where's McCabe at every tech hearing? Just look for him in the background somewhere.
I think I see McCabe. Oh, no, that's not McCabe. All right, so driverless car regulation. It's at the same time necessary, obviously, but it's also potentially damaging to the development of this relatively new technology. It's a big growth period right now for this technology, and you don't want to stop that in its tracks if you can avoid it. It's necessary because lives are on the line. It's damaging because too much of the wrong kind of regulation too soon could considerably hamper the evolution of a technology that would ultimately save lives. We're kind of caught in the middle of the moment. And joining us to talk about this thing we call a rock and a hard place is Tim Lee from Ars Technica. Welcome, Tim.
Hi, Jason. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. It's great to get you here. So first, let's begin with the Uber accident that happened last month in Arizona. And your article, very well-written article, everybody should check it out on Ars Technica, kind of uses that as like the pivotal starting point, kind of sets the stage. What is it about this particular scenario that demonstrates the challenge of where we stand with self-driving car regulation at the moment?
Well, right now, so the main focus of self-driving car regulation is on the design of the physical car itself. So that accident involved a Volvo vehicle that met all the federal safety regulations. The problem, obviously, is that it had this self-driving software that was being tested, and it had a safety driver who was supposed to be watching the road, but instead was looking down in your lap, maybe looking at a cell phone or something. And there were lots of aspects of this testing program that were not just not covered at all by conventional regulations, which focus on things like the brakes or the airbags or the tires and that kind of thing.
Now, one of the interesting parts about the story is the fact that the competitors, Waymo in particular, were quick to come out and say, I don't think our technology would have had the same result. I think our technology would have seen the pedestrian. Now, that's okay. Of course, that's just company on company harping, but there's another important point out of that, which is if you have multiple technologies, competing technologies, and one of them would cause a death and the other one will not, how does that not lead to regulation? How does that not lead to this is the only one you can use if you want to be legally protected?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's tricky, though, because the technology is changing so quickly, and I don't think any of these companies are claiming that their technology is quite finished. I mean, this seems like it should have been a fairly easy case. It was a 3 or 4 lane road. The woman was walking relatively slowly across the road. So I think any reasonable technology should have caught it. But you definitely wouldn't want to freeze it right now and say, okay, Waymo's technology is the best, so everybody's technology needs to be like Waymo's, because probably somebody will come up with, or maybe Waymo will come up with something better than what Waymo has right now.
Talk a little bit about kind of the differences between the old school and the new school, let's say the conventional vehicles that were, that were basically tested on private tracks because you aren't relying on a computer that needs to learn, all of these scenarios. Now we're in the new school where a lot of that instruction is happening in real world scenarios. So basically the public is the testing ground. How has this been missed in being addressed by federal officials?
Yeah, so traditional safety regulation, as I was saying before, it focuses on something like the brakes, right, where there's a federal rule that says, the car has to stop within this many feet on this kind of pavement, et cetera. And so you can just build a private test track and you can do very precise measurement and say, okay, the car stopped in this many feet, and that's within the federal requirement. It's not clear that it's possible to write a similar kind of regulation that says, here's a list of all the kinds of circumstances that a self-driving car has to navigate gracefully, because it's literally like every possible circumstance. You want the car to be able to handle it well. And so it's just not possible to create a test track for that, because you'd have to create a test track that looks like the entire world. And so you can do a certain amount of testing on a test track. But at some point you say, okay, like I've tested all the scenarios I could think of, but now I have to go out and try the scenarios I haven't thought of. Like, you know, in Arizona, you had a case in the middle of the night with a woman who was walking a bicycle. We don't know exactly what it was about that scenario that confused the Uber vehicle, but it's easy to imagine Uber setting up lots of tests in a private track and not thinking of having a woman pushing a bicycle at night being like one of the things on the list of things they test. And so there's just unavoidable, you're going to have to, if you ever want these technologies to be fully tested, you're going to have to do some of the testing in a public setting.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that public setting, because this is actually a very interesting sub-story to the overall issue. And that is, there's a semi-competition between states for the dollars that this kind of testing will bring in. California mm-hmm. is notoriously difficult. There's a lot of reporting that has to take place. There's a lot of testing and a lot of proof that has to be submitted before you can run your autonomous fleet. Versus mm-hmm. Arizona. And Arizona, for better or for the worse, they basically, as a state, said, you can come on in, and we've got so much land and road for you to test on that we think it'll be okay. It's actually probably not a surprise that this first accident happened in Arizona, because their reporting mm-hmm. is nowhere near what you get in California. Are we going to get into the situation where states are going to be competing for these dollars, and they'll just say, look, do your best and try not to kill too many people, and as long as you bring jobs into our state, it's all good?
Yeah, and that's a great point. I don't even know if I'd go as far as saying that California is notoriously difficult. I mean, California has a relatively thorough, rigorous transparency regime where you have to say, you know, every time your car is in a crash, you have to tell the government about it. Once a year, you have to submit a report that says, this is how many miles we've driven. This is the number of times our safety drivers had to take over for safety-related reasons. There were some right restrictions on completely automated testing without safety drivers. But for the most part, I mean, Google and now Waymo has done hundreds of thousands of miles of testing. Cruise is doing most of its testing in San Francisco. So I think it's certainly doable, but it's absolutely true that companies, all else equal, generally would like to have fewer restrictions rather than more. And California is a big state that has Silicon Valley in it. So it has a certain amount of leverage where it can say, we're going to have these regulations, and at least some companies will continue testing there. But other states that want to attract people, there is, I think, a little bit of a race to the bottom where states try to have as few restrictions as possible. And Arizona kind of won that race because they, as far as I can tell, they just don't have any significant restrictions on testing and any significant transparency and reporting requirements.
Yeah, that was definitely one of the questions that I had, as far as like why these other states don't do things like, you know, requiring them to hand over information. Like that seems like a no brainer, especially on a technology that's being tested in the public that has, you know, the consequence of putting just anyone's life potentially in danger. That seems like a no brainer. Now, you argue that the National Transportation Safety Board is only investigating officially fatal crashes. Talk a little bit about what is gained by opening that up. Like, obviously fatal crashes to be investigated, but I mean, there are probably a lot of other, you know, crashes that happen that obviously are not fatal, but there's information to be learned from that, right? To accelerate this process.
Right. That's exactly right. So I wouldn't want to say it's only fatal crashes. I mean, the NTSB picks the most significant crashes, and generally speaking, those are the fatal ones, because obviously those are the ones where there's kind of the most at stake. So like as you're showing on the screen, like the Uber crash, that's one they're investigating. They're investigating this Tesla crash involving a semi-autonomous vehicle in Mountain View that also happened last month. I think the thing that maybe people haven't totally figured out is that, you know, when you investigate a crash with a human driver, usually the cause is something we understand pretty well. You know, somebody was intoxicated, somebody was distracted, maybe there was just a kind of regular mechanical failure. And, you know, the point of these investigations is to learn new things and make things safer. But if it's a category of crash that we've seen 100 or 1,000 or a million times before, you're not going to learn that much. But almost by definition, like a crash with a self-driving car is something we haven't seen very much, because we just haven't put very many miles on the road, and we haven't been doing this for very long. And so I think it would be useful if there was a little bit more of a focus on, you know, looking at cases where there was a crash, but maybe nobody died, but maybe somebody could have died, or just the car was behaving in a surprising or unusual way that could indicate some kind of malfunction. Like, for example, last year, also in Tempe, Arizona, there was another crash where somebody made a left turn in front of a Uber vehicle. And the Uber vehicle didn't see it because it was in the rightmost lane of a six-lane road, and there were cars in the way, you know, that prevented it from seeing it. But it seems like that probably the Uber car shouldn't have been going as fast as it was. In those kind of situations, if there'd been an investigation and a finding, you know, either that the Uber did or didn't behave improperly, that would give, you know, Uber's engineers some feedback, kind of give Uber an incentive to be more careful, and would also give the public a heads up that, you know, whichever company is or is not doing the job, which could then, you know, open up room for people to take other measures to make sure that the public safety is being protected.
Tim, I'm interested in that because we do see a lot of these stories. These stories get sensationalized. Anytime there's an accident with an Uber autonomous vehicle with a Tesla that's using autopilot. Mm-hmm. And it seems as if, especially if you're not a digerati, if you're not a futurist, if you're not paying close attention to this, that we're almost spinning it as oh, this technology is killing people, and this technology is horrible, and this technology is going to destroy everyone on the road. Whereas anyone who does even a little research realizes the accident rate is so far below what you get with human drivers that it's still a net benefit. Is that getting lost? Do you see that part of the narrative just sort of falling to the wayside?
I would draw a couple distinctions. I mean, I do think it's important to distinguish between the Tesla case and the Uber case. Tesla is a semi-autonomous system where the human is still supposed to be paying attention. And so the big argument is kind of to what extent is it, you know, should Tesla have done more to kind of make the human pay attention versus is it just the driver's fault when there's a crash? And there's some argument. It does seem like the Tesla vehicle is there's some argument about whether Tesla vehicles with autopilots are safer or less safe, but it's in the same ballpark in terms of safety. In terms of autonomous vehicles, it's actually not. I think in the long run, it's very likely that these fully autonomous vehicles will be safer than human drivers. But the Uber vehicle only had gone around 3 million miles before this fatal crash. And the average, the rate of fatalities for human-driven vehicles is about one fatality every 86 million miles. And so obviously you don't want to extrapolate too much. We don't want to, you know, we can't say exactly what the Uber safety rate is. But based on the very limited data we have, it does seem like Uber's current version of its self-driving software is probably less safe than human drivers. Now, that obviously doesn't mean that we should shut down the program. I mean, I think that the good thing about self-driving cars is that we can learn from this mistake, we can fix whatever the problem is, and probably the next time an Uber car, hopefully a car from anybody else, encounters this scenario, it won't make the mistake and somebody won't die. And so, I mean, the big problem with human drivers is we've had roughly the same accident rate for decades. I mean, it's been going down a little bit, but pretty slowly, whereas potentially we could have a very rapid rate of improvement with fully self-driving cars, because you can update the software and then push that out to every car on the road.
Interesting. Another point from your article that I just hadn't really considered very much is this idea that as we move into a world of non-ownership, where we're relying on fully autonomous vehicles that we don't own, we're, you know, using someone else's fleet, that there's this whole, you know, level of post-sale testing that we see with conventional vehicles, where, you know, even after, you know, it's sold and out on the market, there's still kind of a stream of data and information about how it's performing and what you can learn from that. How is that different here? I mean, that would be cut off because they would do just enough to get the vehicle to pass and you know, to release this and put it in use, but then it's still privately owned and they don't want to share that information beyond there?
Yeah, that's right. So if you think about the leading companies in this market right now, you got Waymo, you got Cruise, and you got Uber are probably the three that at least have done the most testing. All three of them have said that their plan is to have a taxi service. You're never going to be able to buy, at least not anytime soon, you're not going to be able to buy a Waymo car. If you live in the Phoenix area, you'll be able to rent a Waymo car. And so then if you want to do any kind of testing on the car to see, is it safe? Is it good for the environment, et cetera? That's just not going to be an option. And so if you think about, like, there's been researchers who've looked into car hacking, for example, where they'll just buy a particular model of car and do, you know, do forensic analysis to figure out, are there, like, security vulnerabilities in this car? That's just not going to be an option unless either Waymo, for some reason, you know, voluntarily submits to that kind of auditing, or if the government requires it. And so it's just a different world. And I think that presumably we do want these cars to be tested by third parties. And so we need to have some kind of framework for making sure that that happens.
Absolutely. I don't know how long we're going to have to wait before every single vehicle on the road is fully autonomous. I don't even know if it's within my lifetime, but it's important to think about these things now. And that it's a fantastic article, ArsTechnica.com. Look for Tim Lee's article, The Way We Regulate Self-Driving Cars is Broken, and Here's How to Fix It. Tim, thank you so much for joining us today. Where do you want people to find your specific work online? Are you on Twitter?
I am on Twitter. I'm at Binary Bits. And obviously Ars Technica is where almost all my articles go.
Of course. Right on, Tim. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Have a good night.
You know, every time I think of self-driving cars, I'm thinking United States is an interesting use case. It's a great place to test the technology. But then I've been going overseas a lot, and I couldn't even think of what a self-driving car would look like in Rome. I mean, the traffic patterns there are ridiculous. Nobody pays attention to the rules.
We need self-driving bicycles.
No, we just need the walkways. Just the people mover walkways all through the city.
Self-walking people. That's what we need.
We've solved it.
Yeah,
we've solved it here on Tech News Weekly.
All right, good. Now that we've done that, whatever that was. Up next, Common Sense Media put out a cautionary report that talks about today's kids and their interactions with virtual reality. We're going to talk a little bit about that. But first, Megan has this word from our sponsor.
This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by LinkedIn Marketing Solutions. LinkedIn is a great place. And I want to tell you about it. If you want your customers, if you want to find them where they are every day, that's where they are, LinkedIn, and they're ready to make business decisions. LinkedIn can help. They are the world's largest professional network. You have the opportunity to build long-term relationships with your customers, relationships that often translate into high-quality leads, website traffic, and higher brand awareness. It's all about connecting with the right audience when your message will resonate the most. And the first step, talking to the right audience. Every day, over 500 million professionals engage with content on LinkedIn, and chances are your future customers are among them. They're right there waiting for you. LinkedIn has the marketing tools to help you target your customers with precision down to their job title, company name, and industry. Better targeting equals a message your customers care about, which in turn leads to more trust built with your customers. In fact, 4 out of 5 customers on LinkedIn are decision makers at their companies, so you're building relationships that really matter. You can promote your business with LinkedIn Marketing Solutions. Right now, you can redeem a free $100 LinkedIn ad credit. Go to linkedin.com/TNW. I'll say that again, linkedin.com/TNW. That way they know that we sent you there. That's linkedin.com/TNW for your free $100 ad credit. Terms and conditions apply, and we thank LinkedIn Marketing Solutions for their support of Tech News Weekly.
Thank you, Megan. Wait, you're not Megan.
No,
it's like you're sitting in the same episode.
We swapped real fast. She's good. She's really, really
good. Really good. Even on vacation, she drops in here to sponsor read. Virtual reality's come down to earth, I'd say, a bit after riding high on people's radars for the past few years. It's been kind of a year of settling a little bit. But it's also become a bit more affordable and accessible with smartphones that can easily transform into VR displays. More and more consumers have a VR device to satisfy their curiosity. And kids are just as interested to see what it's all about. I know because I've got 2 kids and they are very interested in VR when I let them do it, which is not very often, which is probably a good thing because parents apparently should know what the effect is when their young ones are spending time in this immersive virtual world. And joining us to discuss a new report about what we need to know about kids and VR is Michael Robb, Director of Research at Common Sense Media. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. It's great to get you here. I'm a huge fan of Common Sense Media, so I love the fact that we can get you guys on here. I refer to it a lot for movies, but you guys also do these very thoughtful reports, and this is no different. Talk a little bit about how you approached this report and what exactly went into the process.
Yeah, so you know, we try to think ahead. We know that parents and educators and even policymakers are going to need to know more about VR devices and what these high-tech, high immersion experiences are going to mean for young people. And I think it's probably a little too early to determine how influential VR is going to be, but it's pretty clear from our research that it's slowly becoming more integrated into American homes. And, you know, when we think about past technology shifts. You know, for example, how quickly mobile devices and social media have become part of our daily lives. And it's not too far a stretch to think about, you know, what will VR be like in 5 or 10 years? Because that's, you know, where the next wave of tech adoption seems to be. You know, VR, AR, Internet of Things. You know, that's what's coming down the pike for kids. So we really need research, basically, to give people the information they need to make good choices about their digital lives. And from our perspective, that means understanding how VR might affect kids' development and also capturing parents' perspectives on the potential benefits and drawbacks of having VR devices in the home. And we actually, for this report, we partnered up with one of the premier VR labs, the Stanford Virtual Human Interaction Lab, to help us do this report and conduct some research.
Michael, let's say we've got some new parents coming here at our studio. If you had to bottom line it for them, what would be like something that you would tell them to look out for? What would be the biggest impact that you think they need to watch for as their children start to use VR?
I mean, the thing that we say kind of repeatedly in the report is that VR is likely to have powerful effects on kids because it can provoke a response to virtual experiences in a way that's similar to actual experiences. And that's because VR creates, you know, what they call psychological presence, right? It feels like you are there. And, you know, if it's really well done, then you are kind of temporarily suspending the sense that your experience is being mediated by VR. And instead, it feels like you're having that real experience. So, you know, if you're in VR and you walk up to an object, the object gets bigger. If you touch the object, you can manipulate it. If an object falls from a table, the sound gets louder as your head turns toward it. You know, one of the more fun demos that I've done, you know, asks you to walk off a very realistic cliff, right? And in my head, I know I'm safe. I'm not actually going to fall off anything, but, you know, it's hard to convince your mind and body, mm-hmm. you know, to just go and walk off that cliff. And that's the secret sauce of VR, right? And that's what distinguishes it from other media. So we do urge parents, I think, to be a little bit cautious in thinking about, like, if this is something that you'd want your child to experience in real life or not. And that can be a way to determine whether it's a good use of VR or not.
Now, I don't think it's any secret that there's a psychological component to VR. I mean, that's what makes VR VR. It can fool you. It can fool your senses into thinking things are there when they're not there, or that you're actually doing actions that you're not really doing. But I'm wondering how much of this is the new technology that becomes scary, just like television was before that, or radio was before that. I remember growing up and people were saying, you don't want kids watching television because they can't distinguish between what's actually happening and what they see on the screen. Is this just the next generation of that, or has the technology evolved to a point where no, there's actually much more? It actually does change the way the human mind develops when, as a child, you can imagine yourself flying through the air.
It's a great question, and it is absolutely the same question that comes up whenever a new technology starts to be integrated into American homes. It happened with radio, it happened with comic books, it happened with TV, it happened with movies, mm-hmm. certainly with smartphones. And now here we are again in virtual reality. And the question is, how much of our concern is kind of well-founded versus how much is just the same kind of moral panic that comes up with other technologies? And, you know, the short and unsatisfying answer is we kind of don't know yet. Like, I think we have reason to believe that it is quite different than other medium, and it's potentially more powerful because of that immersive effect. But in terms of its long-term effects on kids, we don't know. Kids are a special audience, right? Like, I think as you were implying, you know, kids can have trouble distinguishing between what's real and what's make-believe. And that's already, you know, part of a normal part of child development. And VR makes that even trickier for a young child to tell what's real and what's not. And so, you know, your senses can be heightened. You might be more anxious or scared in VR just because it's more intense, but you could also have more positive emotions. You know, you could be more awestruck or more joyous. And, you know, like I said, I think that is kind of what it comes down to, is if you wouldn't want your kid to have the same experience in real life, I wouldn't do it in VR. And vice versa, if there's something that you can do in VR that you couldn't do otherwise that's positive, that's great. You know, that's where you start seeing things like, you know, VR field trips and other kinds of immersive experiences that are maybe things that could not be experienced in the real world that can bring real benefit for kids.
Yeah, and we're hearing, you know, Google has their Google Expeditions effort, which is basically putting its cardboard line of VR products into the classroom, with the idea being that, you know, it's a new way of learning. It's an immersive way to, you know, find yourself in the middle of some, you know, historic landmark in a new, different way. Does that immersion, like being so immersed in a learning environment like that, does that actually improve their understanding? Like, has that been proven that this is a better way of learning about these things than, say, a lack of VR in learning this material?
Like a book?
Yeah, right. Or an encyclopedia or whatever. I don't know. Does it change things?
It's a great question. And honestly, the research so far is pretty scarce. Right. Well, so what we do have so far suggests that VR might be better thought of as an engagement tool, but not necessarily a silver bullet for learning. And that's because in the research that they've done with kids, they find that students feel maybe more enthusiasm for learning while using VR, right? Because it could be exciting, it could be novel, but they don't necessarily learn more in VR than they do from, you know, for example, video or computer games. Mm-hmm. What that means, though, is that, you know, VR experiences might lend themselves well to lessons that can spark kids' curiosity and maybe lead to more in-depth activities that can get learning to stick. And certainly, you know, in our survey that we did in conjunction with the report, we found that parents really believe in the potential of VR. In fact, 62% of them say that they think that VR is going to provide educational experiences for their kids. And for owners of VR, like once you already have it, that number goes up to 84% who think it's going to provide educational experiences. So those people who have it are believers. And like you mentioned, the Google Expeditions, you know, that seems particularly well suited to, you know, what we sometimes call the reverse field trip. And that's, you know, you can help kids experiences, places and events, even other time periods in history that can coincide with what they're already learning in school. And that's great. And it, again, it can bring things into kids' lives that they would not otherwise be able to experience. Will it improve their learning? I don't think we necessarily know, but for sure what we do know is that for it to have a real positive effect, we're going to need skilled and trained teachers to help maximize those benefits.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. I'm glad that you said that it's not a silver bullet, because I think there's a lot of people who think, oh yeah, the technology, as soon as it gets better.
The classroom.
Yeah. You know, because on one side of the spectrum, you have Ready Player One, and on the other side, you've got the Nintendo Virtual Boy. And as we get closer to Ready Player One, that's everything. Yeah. But I just came back from Las Vegas and NAB, and it was interesting how many of the big booths were really pushing VR, specifically VR for the classrooms, and how many of them were trying to explain this is not just put on the headset and let's go visit a historical site. This is you have to plan for months and months and years in order to have a good educational experience. How close are we to actually realizing that in the classroom? Because I saw this transition when we first started doing things like putting laptops in the hands of students, where the first generation was just, we're going to buy you a laptop. We have no idea how you're going to use it, but we assume it will make your educational experience better. We don't want that. We want actual integration with lesson plans. Is that close, or is that still a pipe dream?
There's a lag. There's definitely lag, and it happened with laptops. It definitely happened with tablets. You know, people would just like buy tons of iPads for the classroom and just kind of hope that iPads plus children would equal learning somehow. It's easy to dump money into technology and hope for learning gains, but really, unless educators get the time to explore the tech and there's professional development to help them integrate it into their lesson plans, and that there's really good, well thought out content that allows you to do things that you couldn't otherwise do, then I suspect, you know, a lot of school districts might just be wasting money, right? The tools are really only as good as the teachers using them. And if we're just using them to replace things that can be done with computers or in the real world, then it's probably a waste. I mean, I saw a lot of demos at South by Southwest EDU, and, you know, they were okay. I didn't see anything that kind of blew my mind. It's not to say that there won't be one, but I don't think we're there yet. I think we still have a little bit more to go to really figure out kind of what is the best way to integrate it. Because the thing you have to think about in a classroom is, how many of these headsets are you going to have? Are you going to have one for every kid? Mm-hmm. Are they all going to have room to move around without bumping into each other? Are they going to be social? Like, there's just a lot of physical nuts and bolts having to deal with putting these things in classrooms that you don't experience with other technologies. So, you know, I think there's a lot more thinking that needs to be done in terms of how these will eventually be deployed as effective educational tools.
Absolutely. I mean, obviously, this is one report. Is there a good amount of research on this right now as VR is kind of, you know, growing to be whatever it is? I mean, I feel like we're still a ways away from its potential. Maybe a little disappointed now that, you know, people get into VR and they have such high hopes for it and they experience it and they're like, okay, it still needs work. It's great. Yeah. It's come a long ways, but it still needs to go a long way.
It still makes me throw up every 30 minutes. So as soon as they can bump that up a little
that's
bit.
That's not good. Yeah, that's not good. Is there a lot of research like this report happening right now?
Not as much as we'd like. The issue is kids are often an afterthought when it comes to designing new technologies and kind of integrating new technologies. So the research that's been done so far has primarily been done with adults, and a lot of it's with older tech. I mean, the VR technology is evolving so quickly that in terms of there being a lag between the research and what we know, I'm not sure we know that much about kind of like the most recent wave of technology and how effective they are and what kinds of contents best, but it really would behoove us to spend a little bit more money and time doing that research, especially if we think it's going to become a major part of American households.
Yeah, absolutely. Michael Robb from Common Sense, really appreciate you taking the time. I'm super happy to get you on here. Where can people follow the other work that you're doing?
Come to www.commonsense.org. We have an array of amazing resources if you're interested in VR or other kinds of media, especially if you're trying to find good stuff that you can use with your kids.
Absolutely. And like I said, I use your site all the time, Common Sense Media anyways. So I really appreciate it. It's awesome to get you on. And thanks. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
You know, I was just wondering what's going to come sooner, the perfect educational use of VR or the release of a Magic Leap product.
Ooh, I don't know, man. I could really go either
way. I'm pretty sure Magic Leap's going to say we have exciting new technology and it'll never be released.
They're still going to get that funding, though, they still apparently. funding a dream. Finally, there have been a number of ways to integrate technology into improving or understanding how we sleep at night. I'm not sure I saw this one coming, though, and you might agree, the Somnox robot, if you want to call it a robot, is a large kidney bean-shaped body pillow that apparently had a successful Kickstarter run last November. It's gearing up for fulfillment this July. The Somnox is meant to be spooned as you try to fall asleep. It actually simulates a breathing rhythm, meaning that it expands as if it's breathing while you are, you know, wrapped around it trying to fall asleep. It emits some soothing sounds, they say. It implements a number of sleep tracking capabilities into the pod. It's a body pillow, Padre.
So I'm sleeping with a robotic kidney.
Yes.
Is that what we're doing?
A robotic breathing kidney.
I see. There's so many things wrong with that sentence. There's so many things that I don't like.
It's the future.
I know I'm in the minority here, but nothing sleeps in the bed with me. Nothing that even simulates life sleeps in the bed with me. So, all right. That's just me.
Maybe, yes, I understand. I understand. Maybe a little bit of an outlier there. Human breathing apparently can be imitated if the human actually detects a rhythm. So I do sleep with somebody else in bed. And I can tell you, when you hear somebody else's kind of rhythm of breathing, cadence, it's really easy to kind of fall into a similar rhythm, right? It's kind of your breathing patterns can match each other.
But Jason, what happens if you find out that you prefer the robot to your wife?
I'm not saying I'm getting the kidney bean robot thing. But I also don't have sleep problems. Like, I don't have a problem falling asleep at night. I never really have. The Somnox's breathing effect would supposedly subconsciously transfer over to the spooner. Whoever happens to be spooning the song.
There's a whole area of study here I never knew existed. And I think it's fantastic and wonderful.
Yep. And, you know, it's sleep tracking and everything. Okay. So it's really, you know, it's dialed right in. So it's going to have its fulfillment here very soon. And then, lucky you, it's going to release to the public later this year. Pre-order now for $549, shipping in October.
Or you could just get a big bean bag and put like a little electric motor in it, I guess.
I'm not sure that would work.
That doesn't sound right. No. Please delete that. yes. Take that from your brain.
I'm trying to think of like a low tech replacement for this, but I can't. The expanding and contracting breathing thing is the hard part. Maybe they really are onto something.
Maybe, okay, you know what? I'm going to make fun of it, but I'm probably going to ask for a review unit because.
Yes. Actually, I didn't even consider that. We do need to review this on the network.
Do. Yes, we do.
That would make a great review, and I would love to hear what you in particular have to think about that. Padre, Father Robert Ballester, thank you so much for hopping on.
Thanks for having me. It's always fun to do anything with you. I mean, I get to play with both you and Megan a lot on Know How.
Yeah.
So it's absolutely nice to come over to your world for
yes.
a while.
No, I appreciate it, man. What do you want people to know?
Oh, know that I do Know How with you and Megan and Patrick yep. Delahanty every Thursday at 11 o'clock a.m., that's Pacific time, as well as This Week in Enterprise Tech on Fridays at 1:30 p.m. Pacific. Now, I think we've made the announcement already, but you and Megan and Leo are taking over Know How when I leave, and Lou Maresca, who just had a baby, by the way, just this last
wow,
week,
congratulations,
will be taking over as primary host of This Week in Enterprise Tech. So we're good. Those shows will continue,
yep.
and hopefully I'll pop back in every once in a while when I can fly across the pond.
You had better.
Yeah.
Gonna. You had better.
I'm totally gonna.
Bring your sleeping kidney bean with you.
Will they stop me at the airport? If I try to bring that on the plane, and I'm like, it's
all curled up on the plane.
It's like
seat.
My companion dog. It's my companion robot, right?
You're not allowed to bring dogs on the plane. It's not. It's my sleeping kidney.
It breathes.
Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday, 2:30 p.m. Pacific. You can always be part of the show by emailing us, tnw@twit.tv. I forgot to check to see if any of you sent in selfies. It's possible a couple of you did. Burke did, apparently. We'll get to those next week.
Send in selfies with your pillows.
Yes, if you've got a kidney bean pillow, we want to know. Subscribe to our show, twit.tv/TNW. And if you want to tweet at me, I'm at Jason Howell.
I'm at Padre SJ.
Awesome. Thanks to Burke. Thanks to Josh. Thanks to Jammer B and Colleen and everyone else who helps us with this show each and every week. And thanks to you for joining us for another episode of Tech News Weekly. We'll see y'all again next week. Bye, everyone.
High five!
Ow!